Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, I'm Tom Watson, and this is my podcast, Persons of Interest. In my 20 years in the House of Commons, I was lucky enough to meet some truly fascinating people, but I didn't always manage to spend enough time with them to work out what makes them tick. So now I'm going to correct that by inviting them and you to join me for a longer chat. And on this episode, I'm in Eastbourne talking to Eddie Izzard about comedy, watchers, and being the most boring person in Britain. Marathon runner, Europhile, he's performed in French, German, Spanish, Russian and Arabic, as well as English. Actor, gender fluid, and of course, one of the funniest men in Britain. He's also a political activist, and I've spent many days on the road campaigning with Eddie during elections to try and get Labour MPs elected to the House of Commons. More on that in his interview. Eddie, great to see you again.
Good to see you. I should say why I'm in Eastbourne as well.
Please do.
I'm doing charity shows here. That's what I'm doing.
Which is the charity show?
Well, it's kind of beautiful. I do Dickens. I'm bizarrely 150 years to the day younger than Dickens. I'm dyslexic. I'm a high-functioning dyslexic, severely atypically dyslexic. I've been measured at this. So my spelling was all over the place, but they didn't work it out until a lot later. I'd never read a book, a great work of literature, ever in my life. Maybe a lot of people are like that. And then I thought, well, I have this link with Dickens. I'm 150 years exactly younger than him. Oh, why didn't I do an audiobook? And then we do a financial deal. Then they say, well, record it now. Record the bloody book. And I thought, well, I'll do this with Dickens. And they said, well, do Great Expectations. That's a very well-liked and well-respected one. And so it's 20-plus hours of that book was done as an audiobook, which is out there. And then I thought, well, I'll use my performing skills to do a solo show of Dickens. So I'm now doing 6 shows. A memorial for my old head teacher, Peter Pymont. He was a big fan of Dickens, and he died, unfortunately, this year. And the profits are going to Camilla's Bookshop in Eastbourne, which is one of those wonderful lost bookshops, you know, where the books are everywhere, and it was fire damaged by some idiot setting fire to things, and it's now been rebuilt phoenix-like. So we thought we'd give them the money. So it's a beautiful thing to be here at the time of COVID, doing COVID-safe productions.
I listened to Believe Me, a few years back on audiobook.
Yeah, the way to read it, I say, is to do the audiobook.
It is the way to read it, particularly with you, Eddie, because you do your own footnotes, you actually comment on your own comments, which is just
footnotes on footnotes.
Weird.
Yes,
but in it, there's a line in there that made me laugh. I bore myself with my boringness, and you spend a lot of time at the start saying you've got a very boring life, which is why you make yourself do really interesting things. Do you actually think that you're boring?
I don't think I have a very boring life. I think I am a naturally boring person. I think it's actually a gift. I'm opening a bottle of water here. Sorry. There you go. Sounds like BBC sound effects. Now, I am transgender. And if you look at critics over the years, they've said outrageous idiots. And they use this word outrageous to cover up the fact they don't want to kind of admit that I'm transgender. And I'm not outrageous. The one thing I'm not, I mean, I might say things in stand-up which have been out there, you know, like I have a theory of the universe, which is kind of out there, and I don't believe in a mystical God, and I don't think these are necessarily out there things, but I'm not that out there. But I think I'm naturally boring, and I think that is a plus.
There's a story from your book about the watch given to you by your mum on your 18th birthday. Will you tell me about the watch and how that felt?
Yes, well, we were just like any family, 2 kids growing up. Dad worked, he was an accountant, an unqualified accountant. He refused to get qualified because he said the qualifications don't help me in what I'm doing. He didn't tell me and my brother this until after university times because he was very keen that we went to university. But he'd worked his way up by reinventing how to do accounting in refineries. And we were born in Yemen. He took a post in Aden, which is in fact Aden If you're Arabic, it's Aden. I don't know why the British had to say Aden. Anyway, I suppose they just wrote it down with an A. And my mum was a nurse there, and they met and married. So brother was the one that I was born there. So it was from there to Northern Ireland refinery. He was chief accountant there. And mum was alive. And then suddenly we moved from Northern Ireland. We were having a great time hanging out with the kids. We talked like this. When I was 3, 4, or 5, I sounded like this. My brother sounded like this. Mum was freaked out, apparently, because the kids were sounding different to the parents. So we were encouraged to actually speak English sounding in the house. And we were Irish speaking outside the house, which I didn't know until recently. A friend told us that dad had mentioned it to him, a work colleague, that we would code switch at the front door. The kids, we talked like this to the kids, so we did. And then we came in. I remember saying this wee thing and that wee thing when I was very small, because you pick it up. And I would have been very happy to have been a Northern Irish kid. So salutes to Northern Ireland. And then we went to Wales, and then mum suddenly died. Now, we knew she was ill, but when you're a kid, you get ill, you get well, you get ill. I had measles. I got well after that. I didn't know mum was dying. We didn't know. They decided to do it that way so we would enjoy being with mum all the time and not be sad before the fact. And then suddenly she'd gone. And then we learned later that there were these watches. And the last Christmas of 67, mum had gone out to the shop. Dad had an Omega watch. And mum bought two watches, one for my brother, one for me, to get on our 18th birthday.
I felt very moved when I read that in the book. Did your dad give it to you? Did you know it was coming?
Or yes, we knew it was coming. Yeah, we'd seen them, but we got them on 18. And then I was scared to wear it without losing it. And at the moment, I'm wearing a sports watch because I've been doing run training this morning, because then you can't wear the Omega and do the run training, because it's a classic. It winds itself up by the movement of your hand. So I wear it for special occasions now.
I was going to say, you can't wear that out. There's a solemnity to receiving it that means you need to keep it safe. And
well, I need to keep it safe, but I also need to wear it, I think. So yeah. I just need to wear it for, I think, business days, work days. You know, politics is coming. I want to get elected as an MP, then I can wear that more. But then I will still be going running, and my run watch, my Garmin watch, does tell me, you know, the heart rate and all that kind of stuff.
The running.
Yes.
You won't remember this, but when I was just elected deputy leader of the Labour Party, you told me about a sugar-free lifestyle that you were leading.
Yeah.
That was great for your health, which started me on a learning journey, which meant that I gave up sugar and ultimately lost 8 stone.
Yes.
However, I've not run many dozens of marathons like you. Tell me about the marathon running.
Well, the marathon running, when I was a kid, I was a very runabout kid. Not all kids are that, but I was, and I liked that, and I live for football. It's interesting, as a trans person, I feel like I'm a male tomboy, or I am just a tomboy, because I feel like I'm a trans woman now, and I'm sort of basing that. But I have girl mode and boy mode. I consider myself gender fluid. But so anyway, as any woman could be very runabout when she's a young girl, and I was a very runabout boy, I love football. And then I got into my teenage years, went to a school, the second school, Eastbourne College. They didn't play football. They played rugby and then hockey, field hockey, which has its place, hockey lovers. But it can't take the place of football, which is the beautiful game. The game, didn't we invent football? Surely, to all strange schools that don't play football, play football. You've just got to. Anyway, so I didn't do anything like that. And then later on, I was, because I'm obsessional to get things done, to get my career going, which didn't start till I was 30. I used to push. And I found not only was obsessional in trying to get things going, but I would also eat obsessively or drink obsessively or whatever obsessionally. And I had no break on things. And I had very sweet tooth as well. So then I realized there was a photograph of me on holiday, and I thought, I'm looking very large here. I need to do something about that. Then I started to try and do gyms and things, and I didn't get on terribly well with that. And then I thought, well, if I make it an adventure, I mean, Sport Relief was saying, are there any people who are non-sporty, like to come and do things? And I thought, I should go with the Sport Relief. And why don't I do something massive? I'll run around the country and then I can lose weight. The big idea was I was going to lose weight, which I didn't actually do on the UK 43 marathons because I was eating carbohydrate like crazy. The idea was high carbs, low fat at that time. And then when I ran in South Africa in 2016, which is 27 marathons, 27 days, salute to Nelson Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison, and I never thought I'd done enough to salute him, so that was that salute. And I did high fat, low carb, and I looked much better at the end. I thought, okay, so it is, you can eat fat now. You can eat the skin on chicken, you can have butter, but it's the carbs you watch out, that sugary carb thing. And I know the more I eat sugar, the more I want sugar. The less I eat it, the less I want it. It's very cumulative. It's cumulative both ways. And I haven't had much sugar now for some time, and so I'm just not bothered. I've even had Earl Grey tea. Last couple of days, I've had Earl Grey tea with no milk, which I thought before was but now I can do it because my palate is getting normalized. And I think if you put sugar, anyone listening to this, if you, and Tom, you must have gone this the same, the less, would you agree with the less that sugar you eat, the less you kind of want
to
eat?
Oh yeah, I can't, I feel like I've got a richness of a palate back. So dark chocolate is explosive in my mouth, whereas before it was a dead taste.
And no one tells you this when you're a kid. And some people, some annoying people, usually quite thin people, they say, yes, I had a bar of chocolate. Yes. Oh, I don't really like sweets. damn, because I could go into a sweet shop and literally work my way through all those old jars. You know the old sweet shops? I could go through jar after jar, like the sherbet dabs and the, one of those ones that, multicolored ones, gobstoppers. Anyway, I didn't have a very good break system at all. So if I'm going to be obsessional, I'm trying to be obsessional with fizzy water. Okay, drink fizzy water. Drink tea with oat. We now have oat milk, coconut milk, all these other weird milks.
Do you run every day?
I try and run every day. I do HIIT training, which people should look up, high intensity interval training, which is sprint, recover, sprint, recover, sprint, recover, sprint, recover. You do that about 10 times before breakfast. Do it fasted, as they call.
Yeah.
You can have a cup of coffee or something, but don't have anything. Then you do some sprint training, and then you eat breakfast, and it gets the metabolism going. So that's what I do generally. I've got to do a half marathon this weekend, and then next weekend I'll do a full marathon, and the next weekend I'll do a half marathon. That's what I'm on now. One a week.
The most I've run is 10 kilometers.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to go to the next level.
Mm. And before you did 10K, you didn't believe you could probably do 10K, yeah?
I didn't believe I could do a K. Yeah. I couldn't, when I first started, I couldn't run between one lamppost and the next. So the gains are great, but going to a marathon from 10K seems like...
Well, don't go to 21K, which is a half marathon.
You just went out and ran dozens of marathons.
Yeah, but I am ridiculous. You see, my gift, I think if you do really hard things, positive things, you get given this extra gift. And when I came out as transgender, which is 35 years ago, I didn't know this, but I was given the gift of analysis because I had to self-analyze. What am I? If you think about it, if anyone was alive back in 85 or an adult, you know, thinking about things, it was toxic. Being transgender was toxic in 85. 5 years later, still toxic, 1990. 95, toxic. 2000, 2005, 2010. 2014, there was a tipping point, which people might have sensed this happened, may not have known when it was. It was 2014. Three things happened in America. There was a series called Transparent about transgender, which won Golden Globes. There was Caitlyn Jenner coming out front cover of Vanity Fair. And Laverne Cox is a black trans woman activist, and she was on Orange is the New Black. She got, I think, Time Person of the Year or whatever space, but she got the front cover. And so suddenly, 2014, a whole bunch of things happened, or a few things happened, and it sort of shifted, I feel. But anyway, when I came out in 85, I self-analyzed. Tried to analyze why I felt the way I felt. And in the end, I decided that guilt and shame were not my responsibility because this is built in, but I haven't got all the answers. So I'm just going to come out and I'll fight whatever fight I have to fight. In the streets, verbal abuse, I've had a lot of that. It's got a lot better. And if you get better known, of course, people are easier with you. And running the marathons was also good because if you're going to be transgender and then you're running marathons, that's people go, oh, well, surely I thought, oh, okay. But I got this gift of analysis. So the analysis thing was what I could use on things like take food apart. What am I doing with food? That's all wrong. So analyze what's going on there and start reading up about it. How to be a stand-up comedy. I couldn't be a stand-up comedy. I was a street performer before that, and I couldn't do street performing either. So I've analyzed that. And then dramatic acting, I had to analyze what I was doing wrong. I always start very bad. And I think all I've learned to do is what probably a lot of us can do. And World War II is a good example. Most people went into World War II. If you take it from the democratic countries that went in, we weren't brainwashed, but people said, I want to learn how to do this, to be a secret agent, to be a commando. You know, this is women and men, women on AK-AK guns and stuff. A lot of stuff was done that they didn't think they were going to ever do. And they said, this is necessary to train it. The emergency situation will encourage people to say, I will go and learn this because it's an emergency. I felt it was an emergency to come out in 1985. I thought I should do this.
A personal emergency?
Yes, a personal emergency. That it's in there. It's either a lie that I'm going to lie throughout my life, and you know how much lying goes on in this world. And I thought, well, let's tell the truth about this. Let's say, this is it. This is happening. And I was trying to get my career going, and I thought this could have actually just wiped up my career. I actually came out twice in a way, because I came out to my family and friends, well, to my friends, not my dad. And then 6 years later, I came out to my dad, and then I told the press about this because I was doing stand-up. But the analysis was the gift that I was given to it, which I've used on other things now.
And do you feel vindicated for the stance you took, or do you feel a great sense of responsibility now that trans rights is being discussed almost on a daily basis?
I think vindicated quite strong response. I don't know if I think it, what's the word? Responsibility doesn't quite feel the word because I don't feel it's like, what I'm trying to do, what I realized when I came out was I'm just not going to march up and down the streets.
Yeah.
I was not going to be really the activist, the active activist. What I was going to do was I was going to do my thing, which was stand-up comedy, and I was going to talk about it and express myself and use it indirectly. And I could talk about it on TV shows or whatever, you know, interview shows. But that was it. I'm just going to carry on because I thought what needs to happen with trans is that we needed, the word wasn't there. I was people say, sure, you were transvestite. Well, transvestite, transgender, it's the same thing. Transgender is the overarching name. And I worked that out before when I was young. But we needed to be part of society. We were outside society in 85. We were just strange, weird, negative, toxic. Some very negative words you could come up with other words. But I thought we needed to be part of society. And my boringness, I think, is the thing that knits me into society because hopefully when I talk here or if you see me on a chat show or just people meet me in the streets or here in the hotel or outside running along, people go, oh, no, oh, yeah, what, nice weather, isn't it? Yes, and you just chat away and they go, well, they seem all right. And I'm just like my father, really, because my father used to chat to everyone and I'm happy to chat to everyone. And I think that... maybe it's not boringness, is not the right word, but it's kind of ordinariness. There's a distinct ordinariness in me, but yeah. I'm trying to do things which are extraordinary to impress myself above all, so that I go, wow, how? Because when I run a training marathon, I find it tough, and I think, how do I do this day after day? When I do these, because the last time I went in February, I did 29 marathons, and I thought, you know, the first 10 are always hellish. And then after that, your brain gets, okay, we do this, we can do this.
You said that the body gets used to it, which is what I'm banking on when I finally get there.
And it's the mind gets used to it as well, because the body gets more used to it. And then the mind, because now I know if I don't do something for a while, if I can't train for a while, then I go back out and I can pick up that level of training quite quickly.
Yeah. Why did it take you 6 years longer to tell your dad, by the way?
Because mama died years before. I was advised it may break him. It may break your dad.
Yeah.
And I thought, will it? And time ticked on. I thought, no, I can't. I've got to talk about it because my stand-up career didn't exist over those 6 years. I did 4 years of street performing. Then I started stand-up in 88. And then by 91, that's the 6 years later. So end of 91, I thought, it's taking off. I can feel it taking off. I've got to tell dad and then I can tell the press.
Yeah.
So I told dad on a Saturday at a Crystal Palace football match, because he always had two tickets. My brother would go sometimes, I would go sometimes. And it was when to tell dad, you know, during the match, no, because you go, you're a transvestite. And then as we're leaving and walking away, you're a transvestite, you know, all the fans around it. So in the end, it was in a cafe in Croydon. I went into the cafe and there were three tables in the back room. One was full, two were free. We took the middle table and I saw that these people were finishing their meal. And they went out and I thought another... you know, group of people could come in and take a table at any point. This is the time. I've got a room. I've got dad. Tell him now. And I told him, and I was quite prepared that we would never talk again. And but he was good. He wrote a letter back. He said he was okay at the time. And then he wrote a letter later saying, this is tough to say this. He said, I'm okay with this. And if your mum was alive, she'd be okay with it too. Which is kind of an amazing thing. Because I have heard very, very negative things from some parents who are not... good characters who have been horrible to their kids, and dad was exemplary and always very supportive.
You know, your mum's obviously huge in your life, and in your book you talk about the things you do to try and get her back. I can understand the emotional sort of foundation there, but I guess for you, you'd also want to know that your mum would be proud of you.
I would hope that mum would be proud. I think so, because she liked performing. She sang in a choir at Albert Hall. And she liked her music, classical music, and amateur dramatics as well. She did amateur dramatics in Aidan, the Little Aidan Dramatic Society, Lads. There's pictures of her, and she played Princess Yasmin in Aladdin in the pantomime in there in 1958, Christmas 58, I think it was. So I hope she'd be okay with it. And some people say, ah, well, transgender, that's because of it. And I really don't think so, because I wanted to throw a dress on before mum died. I didn't know mum was ill, so I didn't know she was going. So some people say she died in there four, and I don't think it is. I think all LGBT people, I believe it's genetic, it's inbuilt, we'll find it, we'll track it down, even though there's been recent reports that, oh, it's less likely that. It's something in there, because I didn't choose it. It was just there, and I've just been honest about it.
I think in the book you said she told your dad you used to play with her garters.
Yes. Well, I remember that. Dad said in the Believe documentary, Dad says I was wearing her clothes, which as a small kid, I don't know how I got into her clothes. But I do remember, you know, being very attached to my mother and to I like what she was wearing. And there was a friend who actually had a long haired wig. And of course, boys don't have long hair at that time. Short back and sides, and I do remember being fascinated by her long haired wig. My hair is now longer at the moment just because I've got extensions in. But yeah, now actually, it's a very interesting time, 2020 as we are, because men can have hair whatever long length they want. And if you think of Native American men, they had very long hair and they were great warriors as well. Because I was trying to think of myself as a feisty person because I did want to be in the forces when I was a kid, which I didn't go into, but I felt I've been, you know, Special Forces was where I was trying to get to. But in fact, I've said, and this might be ridicule, but I've done civilian Special Forces. Coming out as transgender was my Special Forces mission because people would scream at you in the street, attack you in the street.
It took courage.
And also, as someone who's a wannabe lesbian who fancied women, I could just have lied my entire life. And we know, going back through not even centuries, but through millennia, people have lied, or people have been open about it and have been completely attacked for it and murdered for it. But I just thought, this is a fight I should fight. Yeah. I'm the right person to fight this fight because I'm very têtu, the French say. I'm strong-minded and I'm just going to push. Because it's definitely positive to talk about it, be honest about it. It's definitely better than hiding and sticking your head in the ground.
None of the things you've talked to me about your ordinary life are ordinary, nor is it boring. Which is why I find it funny you always describe.
But the base level is boring, you see. Like, I'm having a tea here and I have a water. And I'm not saying I want some cocaine and something. I'm not going to have, you know, I think cocaine would have been my perfect drug because I'm so obsessional. So I realize, don't go there. But I'm just kind of, you know, some people are, maybe it's a front that they put on if you get into performance, but they might seem that they seem outrageous, outlandish. I'm not outrageous and outlandish. If you're in rock and roll, then you need to be that. Probably most people aren't that outrageous, but in certain areas you're supposed to be more outrageous. And I'm just, my base level is kind of ordinary. But I am trying to impress myself by doing things that, you know, gigs in French and German and Spanish, improvising in French and German, which I recently did. I didn't even know that was possible. I mean, logically it's possible. French people must do it. But that gave me such joy.
It's extraordinary that. But also, okay, so your theory of the universe.
Yes.
Is logical.
Yes.
Logic. Tell me about the theory of the universe. This is what really fascinates me.
I'm going to say it in a short... I've been talking to experts on this. I talked to Professor Brian Cox about this, and he said the things I'm saying are not crazy. If I try and get it into just a few lines, into a paragraph, I've removed gods from all of this, and then people who believe in gods, okay, but who created the god? Did God get up one morning and say, I'm going to create myself today? It doesn't make any logic. And I think the universe goes from a big bang to a big crunch, big bang, big crunch. Everything comes together and smashes together and then blows out again around the whole universe and then comes back again and blows out. And my microcosm version of that is what happens with the shifting plate system, which nobody believed in, but a German meteorologist came up, Alfred Wegener, he came up with the idea that it's shifting plates. And now we know, oh, it is true. And those shifting plates, they come together as a supercontinent, which is the big crunch, and then they blow apart again, and they move all around the world in a very slow state. And that's what happens in a very slow way out in the universe. If you think of where's the center of the surface of the Earth, there is no center of the surface of the Earth. We're always at the center. Right here in Eastbourne is the center of the surface of the Earth because it's equidistant going left, right, even though it's not a perfect circle because we're spinning. But they're all curves in the universe. So I think if the moons are curved, the planets are curved, the suns are curved, the trajectories are curved, the galaxies are curved, then I think the universe is curved because there was this endlessly expanding universe. And now there's an idea that it could be a looped universe. And I also came up with this idea that I think that, now these are conjectures and hypotheses as opposed to proven theories, that I think that every point in the universe is the center of the universe, like every point of the Earth is the center of the surface of the Earth. And if you go off in one direction for a long time in the universe, you will come back to that point from the other direction. And if you go off in any direction you go off, you'll come back from the opposite direction. Just like on the Earth, if we go off northeast, southwest, you will, if you just keep that thing, you will come back to the same point. So I just think there is no meaning of life. What is the meaning of life? There is no meaning of life. We have to put meaning into it. I think there are no gods because a god surely would have come down in World War II. 60 million dead. If God's not coming down to help us when 60 million are dying, then they're never coming. They either hate us or they're not there. And I think it's polite to say that God does not exist. I think it's more rude to say that God does exist and he's a complete bastard. So I think we have to put it in. This is why, you know, we did the 1930s politics and now we seem to have gone all the way around to trying 1930s politics again. I'm trying to drag everyone towards the 2030s, encourage everyone to move towards the 2030s, while some politicians are saying, no, let's go back to the 1930s where lying can be a tool of politics. And I just think that's wrong. We can't go back to those days of the 1930s.
I've been trying to avoid politics questions, but I'm going on to them now. There's a contrasting thing with your theory of the universe, you see. Your theory is a very ordered, rules-based universe.
I wouldn't say ordered, but I'd say random things, having things smashing together, going off in all directions, but just no one planning it.
Yeah, okay. So that's maybe your theory of humanity, because also in your book you talk about the impermanence and uncertainty of people, and that's why you always want a no-surprise planned next stage. And clearly you're at a point in life now where... You know, we've come out of Brexit. You're looking at political activism. You're reflecting on...
I want to be a member of Parliament. I was trying to get in the last election. Yeah, so I absolutely definitely want to get in on a by-election or next election.
Tell me about that. Why do you actually want to enter the world of politics?
Because I think you've got to do three things in politics. You've got to have a vision for the world, a world vision. And I think there are a lot of negative world visions going on, saying, hey, let's try nationalism again. Let's say us number one and everyone else can take the other route. I think, no, my worldview is that everyone should have a fair chance in life. That single statement. Everyone deserves to have the fair chance in life. Not a free life, but a fair chance that whatever background they come from, they have a fair chance. And that's all 7.7 billion of us. That's what I'm fighting for. And because I've been through such an unusual trajectory to get to here, I feel that I can think in this very macro way. Everyone in life, we know we're all the same. We were 20,000 people 200,000 years ago. We're now 7.7 billion people. If we don't learn to live together, work together in some shape or form, we're not going to make it. I think the 21st century is the key century. This is the coming of age of humanity. And if we get through this century, then we will get through it by learning to live together, work together in some shape or form. If we all start going back into the 1930s nationalism and saying, hey, I've lied about this, let's put £350 million a week into the NHS. Oh, no, we're not going to do that. It's a lie. It doesn't matter. It's a fundamental lie. No, it doesn't matter. We won the referendum because of it. And if you just march on and no one seems to care, then I think there's a whole bunch of people out there who are saying, this is not right. We need to be heading towards a more positive future. So I will fight for that. I've got a lot of energy. I feel I can communicate. You've got to be able to analyze systems. You've got to be able to communicate. And you've got to have a world vision. And my world vision is positive. It's for everyone. I feel I can communicate because I've been communicating through comedy and drama and politics being an activist for over 10 years. And I feel I can put ideas forward. You need to put them forward in a grabbable way for people. But there's also analysis. You need to analyze systems and be able to say, okay, this system is good. Let's keep it going. This system is half good. Let's dump that old bit and adjust that. And then this system is no good at all. We need a completely new system. You need to be able to do that. And we're heading towards automation where people are going to be losing jobs, quite apart from COVID, the unemployment that's coming up here. There's going to be even more unemployment through automation. If we're not heading forwards to a more positive future, I just don't think we're going to make it as human beings. There have been 5 great mass extinctions on the planet, not due to us. We could make the next one, and it's not guaranteed. If you believe in a God, you think it's all going to go on fine forever. I don't believe in anyone looking after us, because World War II is my proof. He, she, it would have come down and said, what's this guy with the mustache doing? Flick him off the board. Let's get rid of him. Why couldn't he get a COVID? Why couldn't he die of mustard gas attack when he was attacked in World War I? A God would have worked that out. I think Hitler had actually 2 younger siblings who died in childbirth, and surely they should have lived and Hitler should have died. So I don't think anyone's coming to help us. It's up to us, and it's up to the goodwill of us. I think there's more goodwill than ill will in the world, and I want to bring my analysis, my energy, my positive feeling towards people. And I think most people are good. I just don't like the right wing because they come with hatred. They do hatred first. They bring it first, and then you tend to hate them back. But I'm a live and let live person, but I want to make this world, I want to make the 21st century the first century rather than the last century for humanity.
See, I'm smart. I was smiling all the way through that, mainly because obviously now that I'm an ex-politician, and there's nothing more ex than an ex-politician, I've had a lot of people ask advice about standing for political office or doing that, and I've basically said don't do it.
Yeah.
But with you, Eddie, in your book you wrote about stamina, patience and determination getting you through in your creative career. And you use that phrase, it's a very clever phrase. You say you always take the path of most resistance in order to get somewhere.
Yeah, that is weird. I didn't want to. When I was young, I wanted to take the path of least resistance. I wanted to take off career at 16. It happens to a number of people. But I think the fact that I dropped out of uni at 19 and I started making it at 30, those 11 years. Or if you go further back at school here, I saw a play when I was 7. I thought, I want to do that. And I couldn't get into school plays even. So even I was either starting at 7 or starting at 19. And the wilderness years, as I call them, and Churchill had his later, but I had mine straight off the bat. And they were actually, that taught me stamina to keep going, keep positive, and try and keep your head happy while you're going through this difficult period. And I'm sure when/if I get elected as an MP, I have to take it easy. You don't run at things, because I did try running at things much earlier. But if you go slowly towards, I think this is for any good advice for anyone, just feel your way in and then see how things go. But I want to go into that. And I'm not playing around it. Some people might think it's just a thing I'm saying, but I'm very serious about this.
No, I know you're serious. I've seen you, I have campaigned with you. I've been in a car with you in a general election where we're going from constituency to constituency. The other thing, though, that interests me about you is you're a values-led politician. You wear ideology lightly, although obviously some kind of notion of a fair economy underpins what you do.
Yeah.
And the fact that you stood out against hate and prejudice for who you are, and you met that with what I would say is generosity, kindness and love, I would actually say they're profoundly Christian values and come from a Christian God that you don't believe exists.
Oh, yes, I can work with religious leaders. I'd say my values are actually Christian values, Islamic values, Jewish values, Hindu, anyone, because the golden rule in all the major religions is treat other people as you like to be treated yourself. If we did that tomorrow, the world would work instantly. And that's what I believe in. I just don't believe in the mystical guy upstairs working it all out. I just don't think he's there.
Yeah.
He/she, or the flying sandwich they may be. I just think it's us. Because if you think about it, Yeshua, who the Greeks called Jesus, he was a modernizer who said, okay, Jewish faith, great, but we seem to have lost our way here. Let's get back to the birds and the bees, they get on right. If you're plowing the field, he was trying to simplify the message there. And then that got turned by Saul/Paul into a different faith. But that's where, so he was a modernizer of that message. If you think about Muhammad, he was modernizing. He talked to the Jewish and the Christian elders and said, this has lost its way. Let's do a more modern version of that. And then the people who come after them say, what they were really saying was this. And if you don't agree with what my interpretation, I'm going to kill you. Spanish Inquisition or if there are any jihads going on there. I think Muhammad said, don't draw a picture of me, because he didn't want to become the son of God. He said, I am a prophet. And he saw that Yeshua/Jesus had become this son of God, which he wasn't set up as. He never said he was that. It was the people afterwards said, he's coming straight down. So I think that's what Muhammad did cleverly. Very intelligent guy, Muhammad. And he set that up. And then people said, okay, if you draw a picture of him, we're going to murder you. And that's not what he said. So it's, I would like to be able to work with all religious leaders who ever think, treat other people as you'd like to be treated yourself. But I just will disagree on if there is a mystical being upstairs who used to live in the clouds, if you remember, until we learned to fly. And then we noticed that he wasn't in the clouds, but no one ever mentioned that ever again, because he was definitely in the clouds.
He was.
And no one's ever just talked about that. There should have been, whoa, we got that wrong.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so look, you want to leave career of stand-up writing and serious acting to go into politics.
Yeah.
I don't need your advice. I'd like to be an actor.
Right.
What do I have to do?
Are you serious?
Yeah.
It's actually, for acting, you should, I would say, you need to do a one-person show up at the Edinburgh Festival. That's something you could put on, you could set up yourself. I'm not saying that doing a one-person show will get you acting gigs, but it's probably the easiest way to get yourself one experience, because what you need is hours on stage, hours in front of the camera,
yeah.
And that's very difficult to do. How do you persuade anyone to do that? I mean, a lot of us have spent, you know, years sometimes years. Decades trying to just get your foot in yeah. the door. So it's a tricky thing if you want to do that.
You talk about this idea of an emotional corridor, particularly yes. on stage, where you've got a range you can go yes. through in character.
Now, that I haven't heard of people talk, that may exist out there in a dramatic world. That's more for, the emotional corridor is more for theatrical work. But I did find that if you're doing the same performance again and again and again and again, people get locked into a musicality, a tone that they will do every time they say that line. Well, I'm not going to go there. Well, I'm not going to go there. Well, I'm not. They just say it that way rather than, well, I'm not going to go there. Or you could do emphasis on different places or whatever. Or you can just be in the. It's not that it's all about how you say the line, but where you are mentally as you say the line. And I found that you could actually come to a scene tighter, looser, more angry, less angry. You could put emotions into it, which would affect the way that you said the lines each day. And I was doing this in a certain production, and I found that some of the other actors might have found it, well, you're saying that differently to how you said it yesterday. Yeah. But I wanted to keep it alive. And I found this in stand-up, that I do this thing of molten material where I keep it, it's never quite set so that each time you do it, it can live. Otherwise, it becomes like a prayer and concrete. If you think of any religious prayer, there is no joy in those prayers. And if someone who is religious, and I encourage people of the, probably the Protestant, even the Catholic, of the Christian faith, which is one I had given to me at school, even though we had no religion at home. When they say the Lord's Prayer, Our Father art in heaven, if people, you know, the vicar, the pastor, the whatever, the bishop said, say the Lord's Prayer, but please say it in your own words. I mean, probably it would just, you get nothing coming out. But if you, instead of saying Our Father art in heaven, you say, oh, mystical holy person who lives up in the heavens, give us, please, can I have some food today? That would be great, and I will be thankful for it. And if you put it into your own words, then it'd start to mean something.
It's greater meaning, yeah.
Yeah, but if it's a prayer, it becomes concrete, and that can happen with a repetitious play or a stand-up set, which is said over and over again. In film, it's different because quite often they don't rehearse, so that if you do 3-4 takes, 10 takes, Kubrick used to do 50 to 100 takes, you will get one that's beautifully different and just feels, whoa, they're just so there. And that's the thing about what I love film is it's like playing when you were a kid. You used to play in the street, you know, cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians, and now they just put a camera on you. And in 6 minutes to midnight, which is set in Bexhill, we filmed it in Wales. The Welsh Film Unit wonderfully gave us deals on money, and we did a lot of casting, and we did a lot of locations, stunt casting of Wales for Sussex. But I said, can we have one day of shooting in the Bexhill Eastbourne area? And we did. So down from where I used to go to school, Bede School here, on the beach, there's a scene on the beach there, and I'm on the beach where I used to play as a kid, and up at a place called Pinnacle Point, where, and you'll see it flashes by in the scene. It's about, I don't know, a minute and a half of the film, but I got to actually really play a serious, you know, a role that was happening and being filmed, but do it right next to where I was a kid and playing around.
How did that feel?
It was beautiful. It was. I said it was maybe one of the most wonderful days of my life, which somebody looked at me askance and said, really? But it was. It was like being a kid at seven thinking, I want to act, because I'd seen a kid do this play. And I think I wanted to act because Mum had died recently and the audience were giving such affection. I felt that was an affection swap from my mother's love to the love of the audience, which is not an unconditional. It is a conditional love from an audience. If you do bad, they won't give it to you. But if you do good...
Yeah.
And the mothers might be more lenient on that. But that was the age of seven. So it was about, I don't know, 45 years later, I was on the beach right down from where I used to go, you know, sometimes in the water there because it's a bit craggy down there, sometimes looking for shells in rock pools. And I was just lying on the beach in a dinner jacket. And then the police came looking for me and I go running from the police across the old pools, the limpet pools.
Eddie, I could talk to you all day.
Thank you very much.
You're a good man. and you're going to make a difference in the world.
Good man slash woman.
Sorry, I shouldn't.
No, it's
that's
very
my
tricky.
Fault for not saying it. What no. do I say? How,
no,
do, how do you like to be referred to?
You're a good Eddie.
Good Eddie. I know you have girl days and boy days, but I'd never.
Well, I had girl and boy mode, which some people may disagree with, but because I am gender fluid. But, you know, I'll say this in finishing, that if you analyze what is masculine, what is feminine, there's almost nothing in there. You could say, okay, men could be great athletes. Well, women could be great athletes too. Oh, yeah, they could be fantastic athletes. Okay. And men could be strong characters. Women could be strong characters. Women are fantastic. Oh, yeah, that's true. Very determined. Oh, they're women too. Astronauts, those women too. Sports people. There's nothing in there except the ability to build muscle mass is easier if you have more testosterone in your body.
True.
Apart from that, nurturing, caring, men, women can do that. You know, physically you can't have a child, but you can bring that child up as a single male parent. My dad was a mother/father to us. Yeah. So I'm in that place. My character doesn't really change. But I now sort of go as Ms. Eddie Izzard. That's where I've sort
of... That's
recently.
Yeah.
Okay. I just thought it looked quite nice because I've got it on my credit card. So, you know, and obviously there's a lot of people and there's pressures and things and whatever. But I'm just going to keep trying to be positive and be gender fluid. And I was based in boy mode up to, say, my turning 50. And so I'm now going to be based in girl mode from now on. But I can still go into films and be boy mode and...
And do you sort of wake up and feel in boy mode?
I feel just me.
So it's a sort of conscious decision to, you know.
Well, I'm consciously just deciding to be based in girl mode now. So every day I get up and I just sort my makeup out and throw on a dress and off I go. But when I do the press for 6 minutes to midnight, I will go back to boy mode. Otherwise they'll go, so what, hang on. And
yeah, you end up with a series of complicated questions where you can't explain the film.
But yeah, they did ask me. And I said, well, I prefer to be she and her if I am in girl. You know, I prefer to be she and her. But if people can't do that, okay. And if they can go, I respond to mate, oi mate, or Eddie.
Yeah, I'm very sorry for being...
No.
I should have been more sensitive
I just,
language.
You know, I just say slash.
Yeah.
Good man, slash woman. You know, and if the cognitive revolution was 70,000 years ago, I'll leave you with this. That's the point where they worked out brain power is the most important thing. So women should have been on equal pay with men from 70,000 years ago. That's when it should have happened.
Yeah.
Not struggling to now, but 70,000 years ago. Because, oh, I've got a big muscles. Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. That's got nothing to do with it. It's are you intelligent? Are you wise? Can you help? You've got fortitude, courage, determination. All these are human attributes. And tigers never give a monkeys about... whether we're male or female, do they? If a tiger decides to attack you and have lovely lunch with you, they never go, I'm going to eat this. I think it's a man, a woman, I'm not sure, I haven't checked. Yeah. It's male, female, got a long hair, but it could be, you know, they don't care. And we don't care all the time. I'm being attacked by a male or it could be a female tiger. I'm not sure which sex the tiger is attacking me. It's male. We get so obsessed about it because we get crowbarred into these different areas.
Yeah.
But, you know, like the whole toilet situation, if you just make everything cubicles, throw all the urinals, throw them all away, and just put all cubicles and everyone shares, then all the queues go down, the queues in things in cinemas and theatres, everyone shares it, everyone behaves better. They've tried it in schools and bullying goes down.
Yeah.
I call it regression of technology because the urinals go out the window, but then everyone comes and they either straighten their hair or sort their hair out or they do their makeup, whatever, and everyone behaves in a much better way. And some people will disagree with that, but I think it is the way forward. We already do it in aeroplanes. We share the loos in aeroplanes. We share them in restaurants.
I've just rowed the length of Britain for a TV program that's going out.
You rowed it?
In a rower, right. An ocean rower.
Right.
And there were teams of six, very primitive conditions on the rowing boat.
Right.
And we were doing maximum of 36 hours stretches at sea. So we basically shared a bucket and a bottle. And it was a very egalitarian experience. And everyone was really self-conscious about it. But by the end of it, no one cared. Yeah. It was a total leveler.
And that links into how the Romans. The Romans had open door, have a chat policy. We, the Victorians, I think, have made it very prissy and very, you know, problematic. But it's just a human thing we do. And it's just waste products. So we need to get over ourselves.
There you go.
There you go.
Lovely to talk. Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
So that was Eddie Izzard, one of the most fascinating human beings I've had the pleasure of meeting in life. I could spend days talking to Eddie. He's so interesting. From theories of the universe to childhood memories to the art and science of acting, to ideas for changing the world. There's passion and integrity and honesty and thoughtfulness in everything Eddie does. I don't say this about many people, but I hope one day that Mirza Izzard MP will be a real thing, because I think that Eddie really can change the world with honesty, kindness, generosity and integrity. And that's something that is a very rare commodity in public life these days. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Persons of Interest. If you did, do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to hear more of my conversations. If you like it a lot, please consider giving us a rating. Thanks for listening. Persons of Interest is an IE Entertainment production. The executive producers are Lucy Pullin and Tim Cunningham. This episode was edited by Matt and Scott at PodMonkey. The music by Tom Gray.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.